Next up, Joshua P. Warren updates us on his UFO research. He's got some dandy stories. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Joshua P. Warren. Joshua, first of all, give us an update. Anything new coming out of the situation in Nevada? You were there for a conference, weren't you?
Yes, indeed. I do have some new news on that. And if I may, George, let me say first that I'm getting a lot of emails from listeners who are trying to look at the picture of the alien at joshuapwarren.com, and apparently
we've crashed
our server again, George.
Yes, we did. You know, we've got our own brand-new website up there, so people are just learning how to play with it.
Okay.
And they found you.
Well, I got an email from my webmaster, and he, I don't know if this is even plausible, but he says that we've been at 100% resources for the last 20 minutes, and if people can space themselves out, then we'll try to keep the server up.
Yes.
So I don't know how people are going to space themselves
out. Fat chance of that happening, right?
But you know, we hope people will keep trying, and if it's down when you go there, we'll keep it up best we can. Additionally, it's interesting, there was a guy who emailed me. He heard my story about me being down there in Puerto Rico and the people telling me that I'd been there already when I had not.
That's funny.
He said that this was called bilocation and that it happens especially throughout history with Catholic saints.
Interesting.
So take that into consideration, however you will. But getting back to Laughlin, yes, sir. When I was out there in February, you know, I had a very noteworthy experience because I went out into the desert outside of Laughlin with Ed Grimsley's team, and he had, you know, several pairs of the third generation night vision scopes. And up until this point, I wasn't really sure what I thought about Ed Grimsley's work. I mean, little lights moving around in the sky, could be space junk, could be satellites, could be anything. But when I went out there, I got sort of a special treatment because most of the people, they leave shortly after sunset. But I was there later in the evening with a couple of investigators who wanted to at least give me a good course in using the goggles. And I was looking up. And I saw something that is one of the weirdest things I've ever seen.
What was that?
It was this huge V-shaped formation that passed over my head with a smaller V-shape above it. Now, I have described this on your show before, but I think in retrospect that I have not described it properly. Because after describing this, I've gotten a lot of emails and phone calls from people who got the impression that when I say this, I mean that I'm talking about a triangular craft, or I'm talking about some disjointed series of blobs of light like a flock of birds or something. The thing that made this so darn weird was that the V's were very thin, consistent lines that looked exactly as if the hand of God had picked up a pencil and drawn them in the sky.
Hmm.
And in order to illustrate this properly, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, Lex has posted a very crude yet accurate rendition of what I saw. I just sat down with a simple graphic program and illustrated this. And you can see for yourself, I mean, when you look at this image at coasttocoastam.com, I'm telling you, this is exactly how it looked. I'm not saying this is some little representation. It just looked like two V's that were straight lines that silently passed from the southeast to the northwest. And in fact, I've got all the details. I've everything is on my website for people who want to go there. If you live in the Laughlin area, I've got the name of the road, the direction we were looking, all that kind of stuff on my website, because I think if I've seen it there once, then it has to be occurring again and again.
Now, were these V's two distinct separate objects, or were they many objects shaped like a large V and a smaller V?
Well, it appeared to me to be two separate objects. However, Ed Grimsley believes that these are a whole series of craft,
a string of them,
formation in space.
Okay.
And in fact, I am bringing Ed out here to Asheville, North Carolina, because I want to see more. I want to go to maybe Brown Mountain and places like that. In fact, later this month, I'm going to be at an event he's doing in Sedona, and then I'm going to be in June. I'm bringing him here to Asheville, and we're going to have events here for people who are interested in where I'm going to be.
Have you looked at through his night vision goggles yet?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what I was doing. I was looking through his goggles when I saw this formation out there.
So you didn't see it with your naked eye?
No, okay. No, it was invisible to the naked eye. But I saw it, and two other guys saw it. And I would like for people to look at the picture of this and then contact me if they've seen something that looks just like it, because I've already had one person contact me and send me clips of birds flying in formation. And I was very happy because I was able to look at that and compare it effectively. And I can tell you conclusively, not only were there no birds available to fly in formation, according to Wildlife Services in the local college, because I contacted them the next morning, but when birds are going over, they're lower in the sky, they're squawking and making noise, they're flapping their wings. This was between 9 and 10 o'clock at night, Pacific time. Whatever we saw, according to Ed, it would have to be extremely high, probably on the edge of space, in order for the sun to still be reflecting off of it some, for the goggles to pick it up. And it was silent. There was one side of the V that was longer than the other. And, you know, Ed's explanation is that this is a tactical formation, and he went into all the details, and I've talked about it on your show before, so I won't be redundant. But basically, you know, I don't know whether or not Ed Grimsley's interpretation of these things is accurate. But I do know that when you get out there and you look at the sky through this third-generation night vision technology, you see things that are not supposed to be there. And what I saw was not some little ball of light that was zipping around, even though I've seen that also at this point, looking through those goggles. But I saw something that was so distinctive that it's undeniable. Now, if you want to get even weirder, and I know you do.
Of course.
You want to take the twist. You know, so I've gotten to the point now, George, where I just don't care if people think I'm crazy. You know, I'm just telling the facts like it is, because the world is so complex and weird and bizarre that, you know, it's just we know so little about it. I saw what looked like these two big arrows, and I was scratching my head because this was so unusual. And then I thought of something. And my wife has given me permission to tell you this. About 1 month before I was out there in that desert and I looked up and I saw that, my wife told me after she woke up one morning, she said, you know, the strangest thing happened to me early this morning. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said that she opened her eyes and she feels confident that she was awake, whatever that's worth. And she said when she opened her eyes, right there in front of her, a few inches away from her face, there was hovering a light blue arrow that was pointing to the left, just like a little mouse cursor. And when she opened her eyes and she saw it, she blinked her eyes and it was still there. She blinked them again, it was still there. She raised up in bed. It was still floating there, and then it just disappeared. Now, my wife does not have a big, crazy imagination, and I've never heard her tell me anything like that before. And she said, I'm sure I wasn't dreaming. What was this? And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe there's a buried treasure, you know, in the yard of that. I mean, the arrows pointing towards something, I guess. We could never figure out what it was. Then, here a month later, I see these two huge, you know, arrow-shaped things in the sky. Whether or not there is a relationship, I, like you, George, I think there is no such thing as a coincidence, that everything happens for a reason.
Yep.
And I have done more and more research into the absolute latest scientific studies about a holographic universe. And if you talk to people like Jim Elvidge, and he talks about, you know, a programmed universe, it looks more and more like that we may actually be literally in some kind of a matrix here.
And do you think they're crossing over?
Well, this could be, this, you know, either they are crossing over or there are some serious glitches that are taking place right now in the program. And if we consider that a computer, well, let's take the Internet, for example. The Internet is a reflection of how the human mind works, just like a computer in general is. The computer is modeled on the human brain. Is there a cosmic brain or a cosmic mind out there, and is there a computer or a program that's based on it? You know, you can call it God, you can call it whatever you want, but is there some type of a larger program that is similar to what we condense down into a computer? You know, it's sort of like people say, where is the spirit realm? Well, where is the Internet? You know, the Internet is not a place.
That's right. It's just out there.
It's a stream of information. You know, asking where is the Internet is kind of like asking, you know, what color is the time? It shows a basic misunderstanding of the logic involved here in trying to even ask the right questions. And so it could be that we have to start realizing that we are not these hapless victims inside of this world over which we have no control, that we, in fact, are a very intimate, integral part of this system, and that there is a collaboration that takes place between each one of us and the world around us, and that we are able to create things. And I jump to that conclusion, and I'm not saying that I'm basing it simply upon these examples I'm giving, but if my wife wakes up and she sees a mouse cursor floating in the middle of the air, and then a month later I see these things that look like big arrows going over in the sky, and you combine that with all these scientists who are saying, yeah, I mean, I've got a copy of New Scientist magazine, and it says the holographic universe right on the cover. It makes you wonder if we are getting closer and closer to a period when our minds and our brains are going to open and we're going to see these things. And that could be why that when people talk about UFOs or cryptids or ghosts, there are components of each of these manifestations that do not seem to obey the strict laws of Newtonian physics.
Are you getting lots of calls and reports of strange UFO sightings beyond what you witnessed with Grimsley's folks?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you sort of the latest on that. You know, I could sit here all night, as I'm sure you could, and tell you stories about, you know, your typical flying saucer, UFO, USOs. But now, here's the weirdest thing.
I want to see occupants.
Well, that's the thing. I'm getting stories now from people both right here in Western North Carolina and in Puerto Rico and in other places around the country that I've visited who are telling me that they are seeing these large, transparent, or almost transparent bubbles that are floating around the sky, and inside of them are two or three occupants. And they are standing there at some type of a control mechanism. Now, if you think about the flying humanoids that we, you know, I mentioned earlier that have been seen over Mexico, and I'm sure you've seen footage of this as well.
Yes.
It may be that they're not actually flying humanoids. They might be in the Wonder Woman jet. You know, it's the transparent, invisible enclosure there. And we know now that we have smart metal and smart glass, which can actually become as transparent or as opaque as we select based upon the current we pass through it, kind of like an LCD. And so I have gotten numerous reports. There are two that are especially notable around Bryson City, North Carolina, where there was a woman who went outside and she saw a bubble. And so the only reason she knew it was a bubble is because there was sort of a glare on it. Otherwise, it would have been transparent. There were two or three aliens standing inside of it, and she said that their skin was slightly darker than the typical grayish tone. They had typical spindly bodies, however. And that she was, you know, terrified, so she ran back into her house. And then later she started talking to her neighbors about it and found out that for weeks, most of the people up and down her street had been seeing them. And one woman even emailed me and she said, Mr. Warren, I know that you are interested in these aliens and these bubbles that have been appearing, but I just want to let you know that they have been molesting me and my sister on a number of occasions. We don't know who to talk to. We don't know what to do, but you better be really careful if you want to get involved with this. And she went on to tell me some pretty disturbing, graphic details about abductions and what she called molestations that were occurring from these creatures. Now, it's one thing if you get one person once in a while who tells you this sort of thing. But when you have a bunch of people in different places who all at the same time start contacting you and telling you the same type of thing, that's the flap mentality. It goes back to what I was saying about these balls of light that show up in people's bedrooms. Right now, for years, I never got any report like that. Now, within the past few months, I've gotten dozens of reports from people describing the same thing. And it's the bubble with the aliens. I mean, we call them aliens. Who knows what they are, really?
Something's happening, Joshua. It seems to be everywhere.
I call them paratemporals, is what I call them. And the reason that I say paratemporal is because, you know, the temporal refers to the here and now. And I think that time is an integral component, whether it's ghosts or cryptids or you know, some type of UFO, psychic activity. Time is a key element. And these things, however they manifest, whatever you want to call them, seem to have the ability to shift through space-time and exist outside of our temporal species present. And so, to me, and I know that I'm maybe getting a little bit too technical and talking about too many semantics here, but for those of us who are having, you know, more in-depth discussions in the research field right now, terms like paratemporal seem to be a much more accurate way of throwing a blanket around these things that can be interpreted so differently. You know, a little green man appears somewhere. One person says it's a leprechaun. The other says it's an alien. You know, somebody else says this might be a demon. That has divided not only our culture, but our ability to scientifically study these things because we're categorizing things improperly.
Speaking of demons, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about your work on the Church of Satan.
Okay.
Was that risky for you?
Oh, yeah, it was certainly risky in the beginning. I mean, I didn't know what I was getting into. And, you know, I was told that I was going to go to an airport in another country and meet with a stranger who was going to take me off to an undisclosed location, or I would end up going into secret underground chambers to witness rituals that had never been seen by any outsider.
Why did you decide to do this?
Because I've been interested for most of my life in whether or not people who get together in a ritualistic ceremonial setting can actually affect the laws of nature. You know, can they create things that you or I might call magical? Can they make things happen? And I've grown up here in Billy Graham land. I've been to Pentecostal churches where people are speaking in tongues and they're fainting and they're saying I'm healed and they're running around and shouting. I wondered, what happens if you go into the Church of Satan? What do they manifest?
Good point. Joshua, stay with us. We'll talk about the Church of Satan when we come back. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM. Are you a member of Streamlink yet? Well, if you want to be, all you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for podcasting and special downloads. Had a big meeting about Streamlink today. We're going to throw in a few nice little caveats for you in the foreseeable future. There's one I wanted to tell you about, but they just won't let me. Back in a moment with more with Joshua P. Warren on Coast to Coast AM. So, occult practices with the Church of Satan. What did you find out, Joshua?
Well, you know, when I went on this journey, and of course, I didn't even know exactly where I was going to be. So if I had gone there and ended up surrounded by, you know, evil people doing terrible things, I would have been in a position where I was, you know, very helpless and vulnerable. But what I found was that when you go into their ceremonies. And I mean, there was a time when we went through a bona fide secret chamber, and you know, I went there with one other guy, had a cameraman. I made a documentary about this whole thing called Inside the Church of Satan. And by the way, I have another movie that I haven't announced that I can talk about later if you want to hear it. But anyway, so just myself and my cameraman and the co-producer, we went through a secret passageway. We went into a room where there were people there and cloaks.
How many? What do you think?
I think there were about maybe seven.
Okay.
It was a small group, but still, they were armed to the teeth.
They were?
Yeah. They had, you know, all kinds of swords and daggers and things. And so they closed the door behind us and locked it, which is not the most comforting sensation, hearing the click of that little lock behind you. And knowing that we're in such a well-designed secret house, that if the cops kicked in the door and came running in, they wouldn't know that the house had any occupants. So anyway, here we are in the secret chamber, fires burning, pentagrams and various designs all over the walls, very artistically done. And the leader of the ceremony that I witnessed in particular, he was giving this very fiery rendition of a ceremony called the Rite of Ragnarok, which is sort of calling forth a form of Armageddon, in my opinion. It's sort of sending out a vibe so that the world shifts more toward their way of thinking. The funny thing is, I watched this whole thing, and there's nothing quite like being in the room. I mean, even when you watch Inside the Church of Satan, the documentary, there's nothing that you can do to really capture what it was like to be there. But still, I didn't see any weird, you know, stuff flying off the walls or, you know, any immediate magical kind of effects. And yet, they actually said that they believe that this makes a change on the environment. This creates this. Well, I thought that was unusual because the Satanists at the Church of Satan actually claim that they are more or less atheists, that they don't even believe there is a God or a Satan. I, on the other hand, I think that there are definitely entities out there beyond what you see with the naked eye. So I did my own little mock ceremony, which I wasn't really taking seriously, and maybe I should have taken it seriously, which, of course, you'll see in the movie, in which I got a naked woman, and I put her out as an altar, as is often required. I put candles and daggers and all this stuff around, and I said, okay, here we go. We have the perfect altar. Now, Satan, if you want to come and do an interview with me, I call you forth. And, of course, I'm laughing about it. The camera guy's laughing about it. The nude altar is laughing about it. And then after that, some weird stuff started happening, and I began to wonder if maybe I had been a little bit reckless in my research, because my demonstration was, I mean, how many people do that, you know? But I thought, oh, this would be an interesting part of the movie to actually try to call up Satan for an interview. Well, as it turns out, after this occurred, I started having these shadowy forms that were appearing around my house. My dogs were going nuts. There was banging that was happening on the walls of the house. It got to the point to where I was making audio recordings of it. And then sort of the straw that broke the camel's back was that right before I was going to go on Coast to Coast AM and talk with you about this movie, a friend of mine who was a minister said, well, look, I need to come over and bless your house. Because
that's a good idea.
Yeah, he said, you have not taken this as seriously as you should, and I know you're trying to make an entertaining movie and all that. So I'm waiting for him to come, and he never arrives. Turns out he called me up the next day. He was heading to my house, and out of the blue, this woman in another car absolutely T-bones him, just slams into the side of his car, put him in the hospital. When the cops asked the woman what happened, she said that some type of force had pushed the pedal, the accelerator pedal, to the ground. That, you know, she couldn't explain it. She said the accelerator pedal was stuck and that she could not get it to come up. And it was like something straight out of The Omen or The Exorcist or something, where this woman hit this guy and prevented this minister from coming to my house to bless it. So he actually sent me a pendant and said, put this on. This is the best I can do for you. I'm in the hospital.
I would just about take any advice.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, after he got better, he did come and bless my house. And the thing about it is, you know, I have an agnostic point of view, meaning that I don't pretend that I know what's going on.
It means you want to see proof.
Yeah, I have to, you know.
It's not that you're a non-believer. You
right.
just want to see proof.
Sure. Well said. And so, you know, it could be that because that I had some level of belief that this was possible, that I somehow, you know, helped create this manifestation. But I will tell you that, you know, when you watch the movie and you see me do this, at the time, I'm kind of laughing and chuckling and making fun of it.
I bet you weren't at the end.
No, I wasn't. And that's one thing that I find intriguing about this in general. You know, just the other day, a friend of mine contacted me and he said, I need your advice. He said, my mother went into this antique store and suddenly she started vomiting and she just, you know, she heard some kind of, he said she smelled a terrible foul odor and after that she was really depressed. He said, I think that she may have been possessed by something. And so he got some holy water and he made a little cross on her forehead and she started sobbing. And then after that, for about, you know, 30 minutes of that, she felt purged and felt better again.
Huh.
He said,
well, it does work for the right people.
Yeah, well, he said, you know, what happened to here? He was a little freaked out. He said, did I, you know, perform an exorcism on my mom? And I hear these kinds of stories a lot, and here's what I believe. I think that there are energies out there that have a level of consciousness about them that are parasites. Because if you consider that, I mean, most of us who are interested in this type of mysterious field of the paranormal seem to find all kinds of evidence that there is a mind-body separation in some way, that when you die physically, there's still some aspect of you that can live on. So that means that our bodies are containers of a sort.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not sure just how much space is in that container. But maybe once in a while, some other things can squeeze in there and influence you in a parasitic way. And if you look at this typical sort of traditional scenario, that there may actually be an entity out there that is consciously taking control of your body for some reason, and we could go on and on about possibilities there. If that entity believes there is a God and is fearful of that God, whether or not there is, if the entity believes that, and then you call forth the name of God and you, you know, break out the holy water and all that, then I believe that the entity will flee because the entity believes that. It's no different than, you know, there is a place, a hotel that used to be a convent in Puerto Rico that is haunted by a cloister of nuns that travels up and down a hallway. Now, the hotel will never tell you this. They'd be angry if they knew I were talking about it, but fortunately, I don't think you can hear Coast to Coast AM in Puerto Rico right now.
Not yet.
So,
unless they have Streamlink.
Even though I'm trying to get you syndicated down there, I was going to take a package, but anyway, so for now, I can tell you these stories. But the nuns there were frightening people. They were leaving rooms, and they were doing renovation a few years ago around the property, and they found that there were a bunch of jars around the property that were stuffed with dead babies.
Oh, my God.
And so it appears that the nuns who were there either were not so chaste or they were conducting some type of very primitive abortions. And
which would be a violation of the church.
Oh, big time, yeah. And of course, you know, it's said that a lot of the young women who went off to these convents and these exotic places, they went there because they were running from some dark history, some controversial past. And So you can imagine these nuns, whether, you know, however they judged what they were doing at the time they participated in these acts with these babies. Later, you know, when people are on their deathbeds, they start getting frightened and they start looking back over their lives and reevaluating everything. And so whether or not there is a God who is going to take them and put them into purgatory or hell or whatever, if you put yourself in the position of the nun, if the nun believes that, and she has the choice between going off to this white light of judgment or potential judgment, or sticking around a little bit and putting it off and seeing if there's any way to redeem herself a little bit more before she goes to it, well, you can understand very clearly why that these nuns might be afraid to go on to their judgment. Additionally, to us, these nuns may have been hovering around there for hundreds of years, but it could be 5 minutes, could be a week to them. It goes back to what I was saying about time. Time flows differently. We've proven that time is a flexible thing. And so it very well could be that a ghost, from that ghost's perspective, that spirit's perspective, has only been dead for a short period of time and is still confused enough to maybe not even completely realize that he or she is dead. But in the meantime, many years have passed on our end.
You've done a lot of research into ghosts, of course. You know, I remember when you were on the Haunted Queen Mary with me several years ago, and you unveiled your new computer system there. Have you ever got to a point where you were truly frightened, Joshua? I mean, truly frightened, wondering why you were even there.
I think that the time that I have been most frightened, and I've never wondered why I was there. I mean, I've always known, okay, I'm asking for this stuff.
And you're going to stick it out no matter what.
So far, yes. You know, there may come a day when I've reached some sort of limit.
Yeah. I'm too old for this.
And I'll be calling you that night and saying, George, I finally found the limit.
Yeah.
But so far, the closest I've come to turning and leaving was last year when I was spending the night all by myself at Myrtle's Plantation, that big mansion down there in Louisiana. And I had gone down there to shoot a TV program, and they put me up in the General David Bradford suite, which is the most haunted suite there. And many people consider this the most haunted bedroom and the most haunted house in the country. And so I had gone down there in the middle of this just terrible storm, a thundering, lightning, such a torrential downpour that bridges had collapsed, and I had to take all these detours through the swamps. And I mean, I was really rattled by the time I arrived there. And I got there, and I was greeted by this roving pack of black cats, like something out of a Stephen King novel.
Here we go.
You know, I checked into my room, and this is not some bed and breakfast where you have a staff that stays there with you. At 5 o'clock, they say, adios, amigo, and everybody leaves. And I was in there.
Here's the key, right?
Yeah, by myself. And, you know, you walk into the General David Bradford suite. It looks like you're in the 1700s. There's no television. There's no telephone. There's no internet access. You get very spotty cell reception around the property. The only reason you know that it was not the 1700s is because there was electric lighting and a toilet, and that's it. So there's this big four-poster bed, and, you know, I'd known how many people died on the property, and at one point around 10 o'clock at night, you know, I turned out the lights, and I started looking around the room through my night vision mode on my camera. And the first thing I see are what appear to be bloody footprints on the floor that are only visible through the night shot. So right off the bat, I thought, this is, you know, you couldn't write a story more appropriate for a ghost story than what's happening so far. And then, of course, as the night proceeds, at one point, my equipment starts going bonkers, and then something bangs very loudly on the wall. And at first, I thought, well, maybe there's somebody here. And I opened the door. It's still raining outside. There's no one around. So I came back in, and there it was again. Boom, boom, boom. And after that second time, I said, is there someone here? in this room. Boom, boom, boom. And then I said, if there is someone in this room, would you please do that again? Boom, boom, boom. And it was that at that time when I was standing there all alone with the lights out, and I know that there's something else in this room with me banging on that wall, that I got that little chill, and there was this irrepressible urge to at least turn the light on, if not walk out of the room for a second and come back in and figure out how I'm going to approach this. But I was able to suppress that that urge that usually could not be suppressed. And I continued videotaping, and I captured on video a night of this thing banging on the walls at my command. And it got so bad that finally I was so exhausted about 4 o'clock in the morning, I had to go to bed. And I'm lying there in bed on this four-poster bed with the lights turned out in this creepy old room. And as I'm trying to drift off to sleep, it's banging on the headboard right next to my ear. And for the first time in my life, the only time in my life, I asked a ghost to stop.
Did it listen to you?
No.
Of course not.
This went on and off. The last time I remember it waking me up was about 8:30 in the morning. And again, I captured all this on video. And I posted it for free on the internet. If you click around at my website, joshuapwarren.com, you can find the footage from this. And, you know, that was so impressive to me because it was absolutely interactive. I could ask it to do it, and it would do it. I felt so sure that it was going to materialize and I was going to see it, but that never happened. It may have happened when I was sleeping. If it had materialized, then to this day, I'm not certain if I would have stayed in the room or if I'd gone out and slept in my car, because, you know, being in that situation and knowing you could wake up and there's somebody standing over your bed, you know, it's one thing to hear these stories, but when you're there, it is a whole different ball game.
It's a huge difference, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that really is a big one for me. And the funny thing is that, you know, the TV crew, they got there the next day, and they saw me all, you know, bleary-eyed and weary, and they said, "So, did you have an interesting night last night?" I said, "Oh, you have no idea." And so I prepared the following night for this. And I really had all my equipment unpacked and set up and calibrated and fresh batteries and everything ready to go. And it was the most peaceful, calm, still, uneventful night you could ever imagine.
Joshua, your website, I think, starting to clear up a little bit. What do you think?
I don't know. I hope so, because I continue to get a lot of emails from people who can't get through. But let me just repeat, it's Joshua P. Warren, but there is no period after the P. If you go there and it's locked up or it's down, then please keep trying, because my webmaster, he's staying up all night to refresh things and keep it going, because we've got a lot of visuals on there. And also, you know, if anybody wants to send us stuff to analyze, we enjoy that as well. But I won't get too far into it here tonight, because we have more things to talk about. But I am making a motion picture about probably the creepiest haunted house that I've ever investigated.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Tell us where it is, and then we'll come back with some phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.